I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. On July 25th, 2019, Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman changed the course of American politics and his own life and career. He was the director for Eastern Europe, the Caucasus, and Russia on the National Security Council. And on that day, he was in the West Wing basement, listening to a phone call between then-President Trump and Ukraine's President Zelensky. And in that call, Trump made statements that Vindman believed constituted impeachable offenses. 4 months later, Alexander Vindman was asked about that phone call in the House impeachment hearings that he had set in motion.
Colonel Vindman, what was your real-time reaction to hearing that call?
Chairman, without hesitation, I knew that I had to report this to the White House counsel. I had concerns, and it was my duty to report my concerns to the proper people in the chain of command.
And what was your concern?
It was inappropriate. It was improper for the president to request and to demand an investigation into a political opponent, especially a foreign power, and that this would have significant implications if it became public knowledge and it would be perceived as a partisan play. It would undermine our Ukraine policy, and it would undermine our national security.
Reporting that call changed Vindman's life. It thrust him into the national spotlight, and it cost him his military career. But he says it was worth it, because as he puts it in the title of his new book, Here, Right Matters, An American Story. And Alexander Vindman joins us now from Los Angeles. Lieutenant Colonel, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. So happy to be here with you.
So you are one of a tiny number of people who directly listened to that call on July 25th. So I'm wondering if you could start by putting us in the room. Where did you listen to that call between Trump and Zelensky?
It's a small situation room, White House situation room in the basement of the West Wing. There have been pictures of the more kind of glamorous room adjacent to it, the Kennedy conference room. This was kind of a smaller, more intimate space reserved for seemingly less important meetings. Although there are pictures of this particular room. There was one picture with President Barack Obama and then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton listening or observing the mission to neutralize Osama bin Laden. Sorry. So in that room, there's a panel of screens, and then there's this big long wooden table and intercom in the middle, and the screens were off on this occasion, and everybody was focused on the intercom in the center of the room.
Uh-huh. So all of you were hearing through that speakerphone, essentially, in the middle of this long wooden table. Who else was there?
So my immediate boss, Tim Morrison, was there. There was a vice president's assistant, Jennifer Williams, that testified alongside of me in the House hearings. The vice president's national security advisor was there. I recall the deputy national security advisor for the president being in there. A couple of folks that haven't been brought into the public sphere, but press officers, it was probably a half a dozen people in that room.
Okay. And to be clear, though, this is normal protocol, right? Groups like that listen into every major conversation. I should say most of them, between a sitting president of the United States and other heads of state, in part because of the fact that, especially in this case, Ukraine was and is so centrally important to U.S. foreign policy in the region. And there was this rocky relationship at the time between what official U.S. foreign policy was regarding Ukraine and Russia and what President Trump was saying. So as you write in the book, the national security team had really knew what they were hoping President Trump would say on this call, right? And specifically talking points that had been given to the president. And you knew those talking points most of all. Can you tell us why?
Yes, because I wrote the talking points. I was responsible for managing the relationship between Ukraine and the White House and being the synchronizer of U.S. policy for Ukraine with the White House. And this happened to be a slightly larger set of folks participating because of the import of this meeting. You usually wouldn't necessarily have the vice president's staff in here, but I had orchestrated meetings with the vice president's national security advisor. So they had taken an interest and everybody was generally on the same page about bringing Ukraine along on the road to integration with the West, helping them achieve prosperity through anti-corruption reform measures. And, that was the whole purpose of this phone call.
Yeah. So at what point did you know that the call wasn't going according to plan?
Well, I write that, in fact, I was quite apprehensive about the call in the first place, because even in the days before, it was on again, off again. The National Security Advisor, John Bolton, at the time, had declined to recommend this call to the president because he had deep concerns. And when it popped on to the schedule, the president's schedule, I learned it was as a result of Gordon Sondland, the ambassador to the European Union, doing an end run, which I'd seen before with Mick Mulvaney, the president's chief of staff. But that's the proximate, concerns. Before that, there were months of unfolding troublesome non-government related policy or non-government related activity that was impacting policy. And those were the claims by Rudolph Giuliani and Don Jr. and a bunch of other folks about Ukraine having some information on the Bidens and there needing to be an investigation. And that was what came together in this phone call where the president was asking for this. The president was apparently the driving force behind all of these.
And then the key thing is that all this sort of culminates in the sudden White House decision to withhold several hundred million dollars from Ukraine in aid that the Ukrainians were counting on in order to buy anti-tank missiles to protect Ukrainian territory from Russian tanks, right? And so that's another reason why this call was so critically important. But Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, what I'm trying to understand is, the public had subsequently, because of the immediate controversy over the call, the public had the transcript, or at least most of the transcript that was released by the White House. And there is one place in which it indicates that Trump laughed. But other than that, all we have is like a transcript of the words. It's impossible to tell what the tone of the call was.
Right.
So I wonder if you could just describe to us, like, you were listening. So what did President Trump's voice sound like? Like, what was he communicating through his tone that we can't tell from the transcript?
Sure. So, if this was the only call I had participated in, I would have not necessarily known any better. I would have considered that, this is maybe his tone, but I did have a way to contrast his interaction on this one, because I'd orchestrated another call, another congratulatory call, when President Zelensky was elected president of Ukraine. And in that call, the president was ebullient, highly congratulatory. The president likes winners and surrounding himself with winners. He was complimentary, engaging, charismatic and lighthearted, joking a little bit. This was the exact opposite of all that. The president would describe himself as low energy, reluctant, morose. Frankly, the only point in the phone call, where he did perk up was when Zelensky made this request for to purchase additional Javelin anti-tank missiles, and the president kind of dug in with this. But I need you to do us a favor, though. Do us a favor, though. And then at that point, the president was engaged, and he started hearing what he thought was Zelensky offering to conduct this investigation when, in fact, Zelensky was managing President Trump and saying, well, we'll do a transparent kind of free and fair election. If you have any evidence you want to pass us, please do so. And but that seemingly was enough, because as we learned later on, you know, even with the 2020 elections, all the president needed was not really the dirt, but just the announcement of an investigation, and he would run it with it. And that's what he thought he was getting.
So it's so interesting to hear that the tone of President Trump was, as you say, like low energy, disengaged. We can't tell any of that from the transcript until this moment where they start talking about the aid and the purchasing of the javelins. Because as you write in the book, that's the moment where, quote, the president didn't miss a beat. I would like you to do us a favor, though, he said. And then you write in the book, you paused in your note-taking, like wondering what this was all about. And then when the president goes on and says, there's this other thing, there's a lot of talk about Biden's son. And then you write, my reaction was visceral. So it sounds like that moment gripped you almost physically. Can you describe how it felt when the president said that, how it felt internally to you?
You know, I entered that phone call with apprehension. And as soon as the president came on the line, you know, I probably sunk down into my chair and just braced myself for what could have just been a very difficult phone call that failed to achieve U.S. objectives. Instead, what I heard the president do was apply pressure to a foreign power that desperately needed U.S. assistance to conduct an investigation into Biden. And I just knew exactly what the president was doing. I had watched this unfold for months, and it just became apparent that it wasn't people trying to ingratiate themselves with the president. It was the president himself that was the driving force.
Mm. Well, we're talking this hour with retired Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman. His new book is Here Right Matters. We'll have more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are speaking with retired Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman. His new book is called Here Right Matters, An American Story, and we've got an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, I promise you we're going to get to the American story part of the book, because it's incredibly moving. And the way you write about yourself and your family is deeply insightful, so we will get to that. But I want to just stick with a little bit more about that moment on July 25th, 2019. Because, you know, you write in the book that you had this visceral reaction to the moment when President Trump asked President Zelensky to do us, quote, do us a favor, though. Visceral, meaning that there was something that gripped you almost physically about what you had heard, right? And you said your head snapped up. You wrote that in the book. I'm just wondering, can you tell us a little bit more about that specific moment? And in a way, it's like, how did your body respond to what you were hearing? And the reason why I'm asking is this, is because as I read the book, the whole book is about your sort of growth as a decision maker, as a morally centered servant of the United States through your military career. And so all of that sort of comes to a culmination, you know, on July 25th, 2019. So like, how did you react, you personally, at that instant when you heard the words that were going to change your life, essentially?
Sure. So I, you know, it's I think a feature of being an Army officer and being in difficult situations, you know, throughout the entirety of my career. I did, my head did snap up. I did look around to see who else had taken note and kind of just to quickly assess the situation. But at the same time, I went back immediately to the business of taking notes, making sure that I had an accurate transcript. In the back of my mind, you know, it wasn't even for the purposes, it was certainly for the purposes I already had probably the initial thoughts of reporting this, even though I was laser focused on making sure I understood what was being said. I was the only person in that room that frankly had the wherewithal to understand the Ukrainian before it was translated into English, and to make sure that there was no kind of mistranslations and things of that nature. So I was laser focused on what was going on. And at the same time, the wheels were spinning and I was thinking about the next steps and, how we could start to reverse the damage that was done. Because in that moment, I perceived a threat to our democracy and free and fair elections. But I also, as I mentioned in my testimony, I understood that there was a keen threat to our Ukraine policy, which isn't about Ukraine, to be frank. It's about U.S. national security interests. And a weak Ukraine that could be subordinated and suborned, words from Zbigniew Brzezinski in his analysis of the import of Ukraine, that threat, that becomes a much greater threat if Ukraine becomes part of Russia's orbit. And that's all those were calculations that were going in through my mind in those moments.
Wow. You know, you write about how you looked around the conference room at that time, right? Because everyone in the room was hearing that, I shouldn't call it conference room. I mean, it was like the other situation room, right? Everyone was hearing the same thing that you were hearing, whether it be directly through the Ukrainian or the translation, the real-time translation that was coming across too. And you write about how you saw a reaction in many faces at that moment as well. So everyone knew something was going on. But then you write in the book, quote, "I do remember looking around the conference room when the meeting broke up, knowing that others, including my boss, had heard what I'd heard. In that moment, I realized something right away. Nobody else was going to say anything about it." So looking back now, what do you think of the fact that that what you knew back then was true, that no one was going to say anything, especially since you believed right there on that day, which you reveal in the book, that what you had heard was an impeachable offense?
You know, it's interesting. It's a very, very small staff on the National Security Council. And what you have is a single person responsible for a group of countries. And I was that official responsible for the relationship between the U.S. and Ukraine. So I knew immediately it was my responsibility to take whatever action I thought was appropriate. That's always been the case. That's always the case with regards to any policy. But in that moment, I also judged that either the other officials in that room were honorable detailees, that this didn't fall squarely on the obligation didn't fall squarely on them, or there were political actors that either missed what was going on because, to be pretty, I guess, frank but harsh, they were not necessarily sophisticated actors that picked up on all the nuance, or they saw some merit in not reporting and preserving their own position and, the sense of careerism. So all of that weighed in on me, but I didn't think about it too deeply. I frankly just knew that it was my responsibility to take action on this.
Yeah, so I understand that given the pressures of that moment, of course, you didn't have a chance to think about it too deeply. But now, August of 2021, for that second group you were talking about, those people who might have been driven by careerism, if they recognize that the president was acting in opposition to what U.S. foreign policy was, and, as you say, the U.S. national interest, I mean, let me just put it to you directly, if I can. Yeah. I mean, do you think right matters to them?
Not necessarily, but that's the difference between the professionals coming out of government with decades of service and that take their oath seriously, and the folks that populated the Trump administration that didn't, and that were political actors looking to ingratiate and elevate themselves through political services to the president. And that's not a commentary on all political actors by any means, although it's unfortunately too common nowadays. It's specifically a commentary on the folks that the president recruited, the folks that the president hired that shared some of his deep character flaws. So the chief executive in that case set the tone, and he selected folks that knew what they were going into, knew that this was not a normal administration. In a lot of cases, the top tier, even the second tier folks didn't take the positions, and you had third tier folks step in because they saw an opportunity to advance themselves, and that's really what you had in that room, unfortunately, at the time. I think in another administration that operated within historical patterns, you wouldn't necessarily have that case. So it's really it's a commentary on Trump and his folks.
Okay. Briefly, Lieutenant Colonel, if we could, we still get questions about that day, that phone call, and then the impeachment hearings that followed up. So I want to just briefly, if you could briefly answer this one, because Stephen Hames is sending us a message on Facebook saying, still waiting for an explanation of how the phone call is considered quid pro quo. I mean, you want to give us a brief answer to that?
Sure. Yes, of course. So the whole idea that the president was trying to advance was in exchange for an investigation into the Bidens and wrongdoing that didn't exist, frankly. I did significant due diligence to find out if there was any merit to these accusations or these narratives that were being spun up by Giuliani. None. I talked to the people that were much, much more capable and had a deeper knowledge within the intelligence community, within the State Department, at the embassy, and there was no merit to it. So I then proceeded on the assumption that there was another objective in mind. It wasn't good governance. This wasn't going through an established channel where countries would pass information on potentially criminal wrongdoing. There was actually an established procedure for that. It wasn't that either. So the objective here was basically a pressure campaign against the Ukrainian government, which was beleaguered and besieged by Russia, still waging war. Russia is still waging war on Ukraine. And the simple objective here was to exchange the announcement of an investigation for a White House visit and the ultimate release of $400 million in security assistance that Ukraine desperately needed.
Right.
That is textbook definition.
Of using the office for personal gain versus for the benefit of the United States.
Well, of a quid pro quo, certainly.
Right.
And then, of course, of the overreach and abuse of presidential power. Because the other quick piece of data that's critical is that these were funds directed by Congress. And in fact, holding up those funds may have constituted a violation of the Impoundment Act, where the executive branch doesn't control the purse strings. It's the legislative branch, and the executive branch put a brakes on something that was directed and legal by Congress. So there were a bunch of different layers, but it's hard to kind of judge that there isn't a clear quid pro quo here, unless there's a really deep partisan bent in how you look at the information.
Mm-hmm. Well, look, we've got other comments coming in. Stephen Sasha says he, meaning you, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, is a national treasure and a true patriot. Thank you for standing up for the best America represents. And David Greenfield says, if you want a hero and a patriot, look no further than Vindman. Courage on display. Truth matters. Country over politics. Standing for right at great risk. Those are other comments indicative of a lot of what's coming into us right now, Lieutenant Colonel. Now, listen, I read your book in detail, and there were many passages that I read over and over again, because without a doubt, you are a man who is a consummate professional, who has served the United States, whose professionalism is exemplified also in your patriotism, who has a deep knowledge of the region that you were assigned by the government of the United States to advise the National Security Council on, and you've served at the highest levels of government. And I hear that knowledge and expertise in this conversation too. But in the book, you reveal the humanity, the man behind, all of those titles that I just listed. And I want you to feel comfortable enough to reveal that same human and that same humanity here. So let's do that by turning back to a moment from your testimony before the House committee in November of 2019. And here were the final words in your opening statement. And you directed them, even though you were speaking before the House committee, you directed these words to your father.
I'm grateful to my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth.
It's retired Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman in November of 2019. Why did you feel compelled to speak to your father in that moment?
Sure. Well, first of all, I'm gonna give you some breaking news here. I failed to listen to my wife and read that statement sufficiently enough times to be comfortable and stumbled over words. And I couldn't seem to say elected officials and kept saying elected professionals. So that's, you know, there goes, you know, being flawless.
I know how you feel. Every day I misspeak on the air and I beat myself up for it afterwards. So
right.
Right.
But that one I have to live with because it's constantly being replayed. And I'm like, seriously. And I glance over at my wife and she's looking at me kind of like, yeah, I told you. Read that thing a couple more times, and that's I'm gonna have to live with it for forever. But you know, it's that was my twin brother served with me on the National Security Council. We have always been very, very close, and it was just an amazing opportunity for us to serve together at that level, to serve our nation, and you know what we had thought starting out a career and giving back a little turned out to be a lifelong passion, and us being able to achieve positions on the National Security Council was pretty amazing. And it's wonderful that he was there with me. It was his stroke of genius to include that line for my dad. And of course, as soon as he said it, you know, it's like that quiet inner voice, except he's loud and obnoxious sitting across from me, you know, I put it pen to paper and included in there because our dad was very worried, and I thought this was an appropriate way to put his mind. We both thought it was an appropriate way to put his mind at ease, and you know to remind him something that he already knew because we'd lived in this country for 40 years that this country is different, and that yes, there might be some costs, and he was very 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 correct and astute and you know. Perceiving those costs with regards to career, but this is a country where right matters, and I wouldn't have to fear for my life, and to less degree for my safety, because that doesn't happen in America, and that's why I included those lines in there.
Yeah. You know, you write in the book that nothing has shaped you more decisively than your father's determination and optimism in the face of far more daunting challenges, right? And you write about his own childhood in essentially World War II Soviet Union, and then how you and your twin brother and an elder brother and father had to fled the Soviet Union in 1979, right? 1980. Sure. And we're heading towards a break here, but I'm going to ask you this question, and we'll pick up the answer if we run out of time on the other side of the break. But speaking as the child of immigrants myself, I mean, I really know how powerfully the choice to come to the United States shapes a family and shapes a child's life. It kind of like fades after a couple of generations, right? Because that myth can get gauzy and easily distorted. But when you're living with the person who made the choice to leave their country, it completely shapes you and how you see and love this country. So can you tell us about how your father talked to you about the choice he made to come to the United States as you were growing up?
Sure. I think it's appropriate to start with the fact that there is a thread that connects all recent immigrants and a sense of perspective about what it could have been like to remain in the old country. And that that is, in fact, what drives, I think, new immigrants to work so hard and try to achieve some success and a part of the American dream. I think that is also something that's shared with all Americans going back, you know, it could be decades or centuries, that we all came from another land with a similar hope and a similar dream of prosperity in the United States because this country is different. And my dad thought about it the same way. And I think we could continue that on the back end.
You're right, on the other side of the break. So today you're listening to retired Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman. His new book is Here Right Matters, An American Story. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Just a heads up about what we're talking about on tomorrow's show. We're going to talk about the return to school for tens of millions of K through 12 students in the United States. So, teachers, what will it take for you to feel safe about the return to fully in-person school if your school hasn't done that already? And parents, how do you feel about that same question? And how do you feel about the prospect of not going back to full in-person school if that is indeed an uncertainty right now in your district? Can your kids afford to stay out of in-person school any longer? Let us know at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow's show. Today, we are talking with retired Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman. His new book is Here Right Matters, An American Story, and we have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. And if you pick up the book, which I certainly hope you do, you'll come across this passage where Lieutenant Colonel Vindman writes, "Many people come to America fleeing poverty and stifled opportunity. Admirably, they're seeking a better chance economically, especially for their children." But he says that his family has a different story. He writes, "My dad gave up comfort and career fulfillment in order to escape an arbitrary, tyrannical government with a pervasive culture of corruption, reprisal, and falsehood. He sought a life for his sons that would be better not in economic, but in moral terms." Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, tell us more about that.
Well, I think as a student of Eurasia and Eurasian history and the Soviet Union, I have a pretty strong sense of how difficult life was and how different it was from what we experience here in the United States, where we adhere to Western liberal values. We have some principles about freedom of speech, freedom of to practice your chosen religion, all these things that didn't exist for my dad. And it's interesting that I could understand this kind of intellectually, but he lived these experiences. He understood the moral corruption and moral decay, this idea that in communism, everybody's equal and the labor controls the means of production, that catchphrase that didn't really exist. You still had a series of political elites, part Communist Party members that profited off of what should have been kind of equally dispersed. It's just a system that's fundamentally flawed and can't really work with the nature of humanity at the moment. I don't know if it could ever work, but certainly not now, where there is a drive to enrich and profit and so forth. And he understood that at least in the United States, with hard work, we would have opportunities that we just simply wouldn't have there. And it wasn't, you know, to improve his own personal life, because he was sacrificing a lot to get us here. It was for the sake of his children, to give them opportunities, to give us opportunities, that he came to the United States.
Right. I mean, you share how he had to start from zero, essentially, right? Coming to the United States, and his first job was what? Physical labor, moving boxes at a furniture company, if I remember correctly.
At 47. That's right. At the age of 47.
At 47. Wow. But then he you know, he's a quick study, and he took the civil service exam and became an engineer, a waterworks engineer in New York, and spent the rest of his career in the United States doing that. I mean, it is a true American success story, as is, you know, borne out in the careers and lives that his children went on to lead as well. I also want to ask you, though, if I remember this correctly, that your father was a supporter of President Trump.
He was, and I would say that this is a strange and common feature amongst refugees that have fled communist regimes, where the communist regimes are considered far left, and there is a rejection of anything that smacks of the left, and a pendulum swing to the right. In an unhealthy direction, in a direction that actually isn't true to form with regards to what the right represents oftentimes, certainly not the far right today. And you see this in the Russian community, the former Soviet community. You see it in the Venezuelan and the Cuban communities. You see it in other communities that have rejected, you know, communism in such a visceral way. So he was, in that regard, you know, he had been a Republican, you know, for his entire life here in the United States. And he was fooled by Donald Trump, which is strange to say, because we all grew up in New York. We knew Donald Trump as a fixture, kind of as a corrupt, bad actor, double dealing, unscrupulous and so forth, but still kind of bought into this idea of not a DC creature that could shake things up and maybe do institute some positive changes. And that all came crashing down, of course, through Donald Trump's kind of failures to lead this country and to divide this country, as well as a personal attack on me.
Was your father disillusioned with former President Trump before even this, you and your brother were thrust into the national spotlight in the way that you were?
I don't think that would be entirely true, but I think they were pretty much concurrent. They were concurrent in that my dad lost his blinders. My mom kind of forbade Fox News in the house, which was a good way to kind of deprogram. And then in addition to that, he was seeing what was happening to me. He was seeing what was happening to this country. You know, the president was not bringing this country together. He was making it weaker. And we all love this country. The president was making this country weaker, dividing it. And all that kind of came together. And I think it came together for him. It came together for millions of other Americans. Hence Trump losing by, you know, an unprecedented 7 million votes in the general election. So I think a lot of people kind of took their blinders off to the threat posed by Donald Trump.
Did your father know beforehand, before you made the decision to testify, that essentially you had heard the president of the United States, I mean, speaking of corruption, behaving in a similar way to the exact behavior that your father had left the Soviet Union for,
yeah,
or because of?
He did, but he only knew that, you know, he knew that I made it clear to him that I was, you know, this was my portfolio, that I was on the call, and that I would be put in a position where I very well would have to testify. And he, you know, I think he was like, oh, that's not going to happen. You know, that's the president of the United States. And then later on, when it kind of became clear that it would happen, and there are a couple of scenes I read about in the book where he basically counseled me to not challenge the president of the United States, very well perceiving the costs, and had this kind of imagined image of me marching into the president's office, sharply saluting and saying, "Hey, Mr. President, how do we work this out?" That would have kind of helped. Certainly, he was right. That would have helped save my career. And frankly, probably more than that, I would have been elevated for doing the president's bidding. But that's just mm-hmm. simply not what I was going to do. He didn't understand all the facts at the time. I did. And I wasn't going to leave my oath unfulfilled and fail to defend this nation when it was under threat. That's just that wasn't going to happen.
You know, the book is this, I felt like I was almost sort of listening to you think through your life and seek out the threads that, that tie together to make this very strong, bond, if I can put it this way, between you and your belief in that right matters in the United States, right? And how to keep that moral compass very, pointed in the right direction. So your family's story is a huge part of that. You write about your service in Iraq and all the lessons that you learned there in terms of leadership, especially in experiencing the second battle for Fallujah. I wish I had another hour to talk with you, Lieutenant mm-hmm. Colonel, because that could constitute a whole hour in and of itself. But it's such a fascinating journey to take alongside with you as I read the book. But I wonder, after you made the decision to report what you had heard on that July 25th call, I mean, focusing on your life in the military here for a minute, what was the response? Could you tell us about the response that you got from senior military leadership behind the scenes that we didn't know about before you wrote this book? I mean, they weren't necessarily cheering you in the ranks, were sure. they?
Well, I think I'll just briefly take up the first part of that question. In a lot of ways, the president was a foil for me to kind of analyze my life and the tough decisions I had to make heading into the impeachment and afterwards. All those building blocks, as you pointed out, along the way, where I learned from both failure and success, that comes through. I think the fact that, I'm not probably as dry as I maybe come across on radio or on in testimony. I'm, kind of a fun-loving, happy guy. Definitely my daughter thinks I'm the funniest and most fun person she knows. So I'll take that. But, your question about military leadership, I think I've been struggling with this one because it should be clear from the book how much I love and how much I appreciate my military service and how much I honor those institutions. But I've also come to realize that the senior leadership that occupies the leadership of those institutions doesn't always reflect the institutional values and in my case, failed to live up to those values, where they left somebody that was in certain ways not really, frankly, able to defend himself because I was in uniform and couldn't speak out on my own behalf out on the battlefield alone. And they did that for unclear reasons. If it was to protect the organization, that is absolutely something I could live with. We're a service in which people have paid the ultimate price to defend this nation. And I knew that having served for decades that, that there might come a time where that might be the case for me also. But I think it actually, in this case, it wasn't. I think there was an element of careerism, the same way that there was in that White House Situation Room where people were making cold calculations on how to preserve their positions and advance and, profit. And I fear that that was in part what was driving senior leadership to leave me out there. That was something that the president very well read into and perceived as he marched out the Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs on that fateful days in June to indicate that there was military support for suppressing peaceful protests. That's the same thing he did, when he propagated this lie of stolen elections, which doesn't even make any intellectual sense because he was the party in power. So it doesn't really, I mean, how truly incompetent do you need to be to have somebody else steal an election when you're in power? But anyway, and then, you know, I attempt to indicate that there was military support for the president, which there wasn't. And then to have people kind of sit back and quietly feed stories about the risks that they perceived from the president, you know, with an attempted coup or an insurrection, but only months after, and really to protect your career rather than when it really would have made a difference in protecting this country. So those are the things that it's hard for me to reconcile. And obviously I bore the cost because the military thought it was expedient to let me kind of go off on my own. And I go into great detail as to why I made the decision to do that. And that's something I'm not holding back on because there's an opportunity to be introspective for the military of where it fell short, both in my case and in two decades of warfare, where we spent enormous treasure and blood, more importantly, and the military underperformed in achieving the nation's objectives.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it sounds like to me that, in a sense, part of what you're saying is that it was also, a bit professionally at least, a very lonely time. And yet you, as you write in the book, your moral compass never wavered, right? Your belief in that here, right matters and doing the right thing matters, that your belief in that stayed true. And we've just got 2 minutes left, Lieutenant Colonel. So let me ask you this. You write in the book that you're living in the great unknown now, and so too a great degree is our country. So do you really think that in the United States right now, given the political division, given what you even experience and the reaction from military and civilian leadership at the highest levels, do you really think that right still matters across the United States?
I do. I have a sense of perspective from a life lived serving this country in overseas assignments and understanding how really blessed we are to be Americans. And we are undoubtedly in a very difficult period in our history, but we've been in as challenging periods in our history in the past, frankly, with the civil rights movements where there were constant riots as a population attempted to assert its right to equality. World War II, which was an existential threat, World War I, the Civil War, our fight for independence in the Revolutionary War, we've overcome and persevered and prospered and moved towards a more perfect union. We are in the middle of a fight in kind of the fog of war right now, and it's hard to tell where we're going to end up. But I have faith, I guess, that this, based on my experience living here and living overseas, that we'll overcome these. But I do have to say that we will only be able to do this if we make right matter. Right matters here, but only if we make it matter. And if we're complacent and think that this country is going to just advance on its own, that's not going to help get us through these difficult times. We need to shake off complacency and make right matter.
Well, retired Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, his new book is called Here, Right Matters, An American Story. We have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. And Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, let me tell you from the bottom of my heart, thank you so very much for making Right Matter. And thank you for spending this hour here with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.